What?
This is all done last night.
This?
Yeah.
Yesterday I assembled this thing. So here's the story. I've been asked to give a talk at the Poulantzas Institute. I'm giving three talks in Greece. One is on real utopias that I can do in my sleep. One on the Wisconsin protests, which I've given in a few places. And then one that they want me to talk on classes and class conflict during the present capitalist crisis. Now, I haven't done any research specifically on this, on the current crisis and the character of class conflict within it. And so I asked myself, what would be the kinds of things I could say that I've thought a lot about, since I can't, between now and when I give this talk, actually do any research to figure out something distinctive, you know, about the specificities that would be relevant to the discussion, that would kind of create a platform for thinking about this. And it struck me that the thing for me to do is to take the earlier work I did about class compromise and think about what the implications of that work on class compromise, what the implications are for the problem of class and class conflict in an era of stagnation and crisis. And that then led to this set of PowerPoints, which involve a contrast between how class conflict was organized during what's sometimes called the golden age of developed capitalism, from the end of the Second World War until sometime in the early 1970s, and contrast that to the nature of the problem in an era of stagnation and crisis. So here's how I'm going to lay it out when I present it in Athens. I'll be presenting it as a lecture rather than just as a conversation. But I'm going to build the argument around two kinds of graphs, which we've looked at different times in the semester. One is the class compromise graph, and the other is the transition trough graph. The pictures look nicer on the PowerPoints. They won't be as obscure as they are here. So first, the class compromise graph. The class compromise graph links two concepts: the realization of class interests of various sorts, and you can understand this as narrowly or broadly as you want. The purpose here is not over precision. The idea is that for any given class of people, there's a relationship between the realization of their interests and the nature of power in the society. And I'm going to draw a connection between the realization of interests and the extent of what I'm calling here popular power. I'm using the expression popular power rather than working class power because I want it to be an expansive idea. This will include popular power as inscribed in democratic processes, strength of political parties that represent popular forces. It's popular power as embodied in the cohesion and solidarity of unions. And it's also popular power that's embodied in the such things as the tightness of labor markets. That is, workers are more powerful when labor markets are tight than when labor markets are weak, because it increases their capacity for solidarity, because it helps to strengthen unions and the like. So for these purposes, I want this to be a very generic, multifaceted, soft focus concept, if you will, not overly precise. So first, there's a simple, straightforward relationship between the extent of popular power and the realization of working class interests. I've drawn this as a nonlinear function on the grounds that increases of popular power from negligible to a little don't have much effect, that you have to accumulate a certain amount of power in order to be able to effectively struggle over your interests. And so probably the function looks something like that, like in the first slide. That's not particularly controversial. I think virtually every social theory would argue that to the extent that disadvantaged groups gain capacities for struggle and collective action, their capacity to realize their interests will increase in some function. It would look more or less like this. The more controversial part is the relationship of the class interests of capitalists to popular power. Now, there's no problem about the relationship of the class interests of capitalists to capitalist power. That would also have a upward sloping curve. The question is, what's the relationship between the realization of capitalist interests and the extent of popular democratic power in the society? And my argument is that it has a reverse J character. That as the power of popular classes and groups increases, initially this is harmful to the interests of capital. But there's a point at which very strong and coherently developed popular forces actually makes capitalism work better. It's still the case, however, that capitalists would prefer a completely disorganized population to a highly organized population. That is, their interests are best realized under conditions of a disempowered popular forces. But they can do perfectly well under conditions of strongly organized popular forces as well. Therefore, there are kind of two local maxima on this graph, one at the extreme left-hand side of the curve and one at the extreme right-hand side of the curve. And there's a local minimum at intermediate levels of power. So that's the general shape of the two curves. And the key idea then is there's one region of this graph in which the two curves are moving in the same direction, where increases in popular power improves the interests of both workers and capitalists. That's the region of what I call positive class compromise. It's where deals can be struck that have a positive sum game, that are a positive sum game, and thus positive sum gains for both classes. In the Golden Age, now we're at the third part of the graph, there were a set of public policies in place as a result of popular power that created the welfare state, that created the affirmative regulatory state, that created all sorts of public goods provision. There was a set of policies in place which basically excluded the left-hand part of this curve from possibility. It was inaccessible so long as those policies were in place. And thus, in the Golden Age, the curve in practice looked more like a J than a reverse J. And that's what made for a stable positive class compromise, because it wasn't really in the interests of capitalists to engage in a reactionary offensive against labor, against popular democratic forces. It wasn't in their interests, because to do so, they would actually have to both move that left-hand part of the curve, that exclusionary zone, to the left, and they'd have to traverse this very conflictual, disruptive part of the curve where you lose the gains of cooperation and don't yet get the gains of unilateral domination. So it was a pretty stable class compromise for more or less a quarter of a century. Yeah.
Would you say that deregulation in the past 30, 40 years has decreased this excluded area?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So we'll get to that in a moment. So this is the Golden Age. In the Golden Age, you had stable positive class compromises, which were the result of institutional victories, which excluded part of the curve, and the strength of labor and popular democratic forces, which pushed countries typically into that upward sloping part of the curve. That's why I've called it the modal country. I'm not identifying any particular place. Yeah.
So what is the unit of analysis that this is? I mean, is this at the
national level?
It is, okay.
Yeah. It's at national level where these rules are imposed, and it's not, the shape of the curve may depend upon things other than what's going on within countries, but these are national politics that I'm talking about. Okay, yeah.
I'll also just wondering how you operationalize the power.
Well, it's the capacity, it's the organizational and structural capacity to struggle for your interests.
Through democratic processes.
I mean, it may include strikes and things like that, but it doesn't necessarily have to be entirely peaceful. You know, it can be collective actions. But. Okay, the second part of the argument has to do, so that's what's going on within capitalism, but this is operating against a background in which the future is viewed by nearly all actors as remaining capitalist. So it's in the context where there is, either because people believe it's not possible or not desirable, the actors are all playing the capitalist game. And what's underlying that is the transition trough argument, which we've looked at. So although the picture isn't very clear here, the transition trough problem in the Golden Age looked more or less like this. The grayed out area is the future. So we're on the left-hand part of this curve in an environment which the material welfare of the average person has been slowly improving. In the Golden Age, that was the general expectation, and the empirical reality for most people was that standards of living for the average person were rising over time. And if looking into the future, one could imagine that continuing. And the question is, what would happen if there was a democratic push to transform capitalism in the direction of socialism? The transition trough argument says that a serious push towards socialism leads to a decline in the material conditions of life for most people for some period of time, until the new configuration can be consolidated as a coherent system, at which point the trajectory improves so that eventually the future under socialism is better for workers than under, and for most people than under capitalism. And by better in this context, I mean better in the kind of ordinary sense of material conditions of life. Not, there's other ways in which it could be better. I'm bracketing those for this part of the argument. Now, the transition trough argument says that under democratic conditions, it's implausible that a society can survive the transition if the transition trough is deep and prolonged. If it's shallow and quick, fine. If it's deep and prolonged, under democratic conditions, it's implausible that a political party democratically in power pushing these kinds of reforms and transformations would survive a series of future elections if the transition trough is deep and prolonged. That the coalition behind it will fracture, that the defections to other parties which are saying this is crazy, it's never going to get better, will be large, and that the democratic coalition behind this kind of radical transformation cannot survive a deep and prolonged transition. So the only way you could get a democratic transformation to socialism would be if the trough is shallow and short, or if actors are firmly motivated by things other than material improvement of conditions of life. Those are the two conditions. And neither of them is plausible. Yeah?
What could happen in the midst of the most severe crisis?
Right. Right, so we'll get to that. Okay. So that's why this is a... I'm going to compare what the story looks like under conditions of the Golden Age. So this is the Golden Age conditions.
Oh, okay.
And then we're going to look at the era of stagnation and crisis. Right. So in the Golden Age conditions, where there was a reasonable prospect that things are more or less going to get better slowly over time, if you don't leave capitalism, because that's what capitalism was delivering. It was delivering the goods. And in which you were on the positive class compromise part of the curve, so you could forge deals and have stable compromises. And exiting capitalism seemed like a completely harebrained idea because it would be so costly. that created a stable environment for this positive class compromise. And therefore, class conflict became channeled around class compromise. That's the golden era. Okay, now, on the other side is what happens in the era of stagnation and crisis. So first, the first graph is what the class compromise curve looks like in the era of stagnation and crisis. First, the effects of neoliberalism, the deregulation of the state, the withdrawal of the state, the erosion of what I call the affirmative state that is positively producing large public goods and restricting the capacity of the state to make workers vulnerable. That the effects of neoliberalism is to push the zone of exclusion to the left on the curve. The effects of financialization of capital and globalization is to reduce the upward sloping part of the curve. That is, there's less gains to be made for capitalists by high levels of cooperation with workers because they now have a global supply of cheap labor and an ability to escape regulation and to move where they want to. And that has an effect on the shape of the curve. The curve becomes, you know, flatter on the right-hand side. And the effects of austerity and the attack on democratic institutions, the attack on unions, the erosion of democratic capacity in general, has pushed the location on the curve to the left. So there are these three forces working together: financialization, globalization, neoliberalism, and anti-democratic disempowerment have all pushed the modal country to the downward sloping part of the curve, not the upward sloping part of the curve. When you're in that downward sloping part of the curve, what it means is that on the margins, it's always in the interest of capitalists to try to move further to the left on the curve. It's too bad it's left and right in this, you know, our conventions. Because every effort to increase workers' power and collective power acts against the interests of capital, because they're not in the positive class interest, class compromise part of the curve. It means class compromises are still possible on this downward sloping part of the curve, but they're negative class compromises. They're class compromises that come just from the balance of power, you know, the clash of forces, rather than the gains from cooperation. So that's a deterioration of the conditions of class compromise. There is also a change in the conditions of the transition trough, and I've drawn it here not as a massively, you know, totalizing collapse of capitalism, but as a long period of stagnation and crisis where the down, where the capitalist curve now has a long-term prospect of downward sloping, where material standards of living for the average person is no longer expected to be continually rising, but is either stagnant or declining over time. Now, in particular short periods, it may decline a lot, but the idea is that it's a secular decline. This doesn't mean, however, that there isn't a severe transition trough, even under these conditions. And one, you know, has to keep that in mind. The disruption of an attempt at breaking with capitalism would still be massive, and particularly when you really, if you really think about the problem of supply chains and the fact that we've got massive urban populations that don't grow their own food, you know, the consequences of a prolonged, deep disruption of the whole mechanism of economic integration could be really devastating, even in the absence of the specter of civil wars and you know, counter-revolutions and massive repression as a response to such moves. So taking the most, the logic of this transition trough argument is to say, taking the most optimistic expectations, there's not going to be a military coup and an armed counter-revolution, and the majority of the population is going to support a transition. Now, those are pretty optimistic expectations. Even under those conditions, the transition trough will be severe, and it's not at all clear that a democratic process could survive the costs of that transition trough. There is, the aphorism, of course, that Marx used to describe revolutionary rupture was, "Workers of the world unite, you have nothing to lose but your chains." But it's clearly not true that the only thing you have to lose is your chains. There's other things you have to lose as well. So the current situation then is one in which we have the following, you know, this is the following problem, that conditions for positive class compromise have greatly deteriorated under this kind of triple process of neoliberalism, globalization and financialization, and the direct attack on democratic power, democratic empowerment in all sorts of ways. That's a kind of triple set of processes that have led to a deterioration of the conditions of positive class compromise. And yet it remains the case that the transition trough is a serious obstacle to any more radical exit from this dilemma that would take the form of, well, damn it, we can't have a positive class compromise, let's chuck the whole thing and abandon capitalism. That still remains, in my view, an unrealistic strategic idea. Is that a ruptural transformation? I don't see a scenario under which it's possible. This then leads to three propositions. The transition trough remains a fundamental obstacle to transcending capitalism through democratic means. Now, the through democratic means is crucial here. The argument for the through democratic means is fairly straightforward. It takes a robust coalition of actors to support a political party that would have majority control over the state and able to institute these reforms and transformations in a radical way. That that coalition is internally heterogeneous. It's not the case that they're all immiserated workers. It's a heterogeneous coalition of forces. If they were fully committed to an alternative world for reasons other than just material gain, material conditions of life, and those commitments were unshakable, that is, they really had a kind of deep moral commitment to a more democratic and egalitarian world because they believed it's a better world, then they could survive the transition. But that's wildly implausible. There's no historical example ever of a large coalition of actors motivated robustly over those kinds of moral concerns, where it would hold together. So I don't think it's plausible that in the face of a long and deep material trough, that those moral motivations would be sufficient. I do believe people are motivated morally, absolutely. You'll never get socialism unless people want it for moral reasons as well as material reasons. But I just don't believe that the moral reasons would sustain the coalition in power under democratic conditions long enough to survive a long and extended transition trough. So the coalition will fracture. At the time it fractures and begins to disintegrate, then there's another option, of course. You could attempt to push through a transition to socialism under non-democratic means. That is, you could have a coup from the left. You could have an authoritarian takeover that dissolves democratic rights and attempts to impose it on a vanguardist kind of principle. And that's the second proposition. Non-democratic transformations of capitalism will not result in democratic egalitarian socialism. So you could definitely exit capitalism through such a mechanism. It's just it's not going to result in a democratic egalitarian socialism. It'll result in an authoritarian statism. That's why this is a deep dilemma. You can't accomplish it through democratic means. That is, this way of approaching the problem of socialism, rupture with capitalism through top-down institutional transformation. You can't do it democratically because the democratic coalition can't survive the transition trough. You can't do it undemocratically because if it's undemocratic, it's going to produce a different end, not the end that you want. That's the first two propositions. And the third proposition then says, like it or not, the central immediate task is how to restore conditions for positive compromise. Because restoring the conditions for positive class compromise is the best possible way of improving the conditions of life of most people. And further, it's the context in which The other way of thinking about a transformation of capitalism, interstitial and symbiotic transformations of this sort, you know, I lay out in Envisioning with Utopian, become tractable. So how do you restore the conditions for positive compromise? That's what the last chart doesn't, it doesn't actually answer the question. It just reverses the arrows and labels what the tasks are, but not how you do it. You need to reconstruct an affirmative state that is an active and positive contributor to public goods. You need to democratically regulate finance and geographically root accumulation, not root of. You know, you need to geographically anchor accumulation. That and you need to deepen democracy. So, you know, the reform agenda for restoring the conditions for positive class compromise involves restoring democratic rights and deepening democratic possibilities. So that would include, among other things, things like participatory budgeting as well as restoration of labor rights. You need to reconstruct the affirmative state, meaning you have to reestablish the conditions under which the state can produce public goods for the both the general welfare and for the conditions for stable accumulation. And you have to democratically regulate finance, disempower finance, and create more geographically rooted forms of accumulation. Now, that last specification, creating geographically rooted forms of accumulation, would mean doing things like the Quebec Solidarity Finance as a way of systematically favoring small and medium-sized firms that are geographically immobile as the center for rebuilding the capitalist economy, as opposed to seeing the central problem attracting investments from large corporations. Yeah.
I'm just I'm curious how the audience in Greece will think about this. Obviously, they're thinking beyond just Greece, but in a lot of the things I've read about the Greek situation, the focus is on the fact that there are really a lot of small and medium-sized family businesses, and that that's been perceived as part of the problem more than necessarily part of the solution, so that part of the crisis isn't seen so much as working-class power being eroded by capital as people relying on the state and family businesses.
Yeah.
And it seems like something particular to Greece.
I mean, if they have a country that has a really vibrant small business sector is much more, in a much better position to orchestrate a productive democracy than one in which their employment structure is heavily dependent upon highly mobile forms of capital. You know, that have exit options. I mean, the idea of positive class compromises with highly mobile capital is much more precarious than with capital that is rooted and has interests in the local labor force and its development. The other part of geographically rootedness that I think is crucial is creating the conditions where worker ownership can become. A much larger component of the market economy and potentially the dominant form. So cooperatives, Mondragon as an example of a firm that's large industrial producer, so it's not, you know, small artisanal production. So it's highly productive and it's industrial. Nevertheless, there's no chance that it's going to close down all of its factories in the Basque Country and move to India because the workers themselves own it and run it and work there. So geographical rootedness is a problem, how to think about it. How do you create geographical rootedness? And there are costs involved in rooting, in creating geographical rootedness. It's not that it's going to itself be a costless kind of alternative. But it's the necessary alternative, I think, if you're going to restore the conditions for positive class compromise, which is the necessary condition for stabilization and improvement of material conditions of life for most people. I mean, the bottom line here is there's the two ways you can imagine having the life of most people become more secure and have reasonable prospects is either to create conditions for positive class compromise or to exit capitalism. The latter is blocked. I don't think it's historically possible. I could be wrong, but that's my diagnosis of the current constraints. The latter is possible, but requires institutional transformation because of the changes in the nature of the capitalist economy over the last 30 or 40 years. And that's how we'll end the course. Yeah, okay. I didn't see the two hands up yet.
So, the question I had was, it seems like under the Golden Age, capitalists had more structural reasons to engage in class compromise. The things that they were seeking to overcome weren't institutional, they were more structural. Whereas here, it seems like capitalists would have much less reason to compromise because the things that are forcing them into this compromise are just institutional, you know, laws, things that are much more easily overcome than back in the Golden Age, where the things the problems that helped them resolve weren't things that could be easily changed by a law or by, see what I'm saying? So it seems like now capitalists would have just much less reason to engage in compromise because these things are just things that if they use their leverage, they could probably change the laws back to...
I mean, they fought compromise tooth and nail. I mean, they didn't embrace this out of enlightenment. They embraced it because certain options became too costly to pursue, and it's true that the upward sloping part of the curve was steep, so that once they got to a class compromise, it was comfortable to stay there, right? That is part of the changed environment, is because of globalization and financialization. The upward sloping part of the curve isn't as strong, would be my view. This is for capitalism as a whole. The question then is there are particular sectors and subcategories among capitalists for which the upper sloping part of the curve might still be strong. And those are the ones that should be favored by both public policy and by social struggle to try to strengthen those parts of the capitalist economy which are amenable to class compromise, and to abandon the parts that refuse class compromise. Yeah?
I guess you may have sort of already answered this by now, but I was curious on the third proposition, why this wouldn't be, rather than restoring the conditions for positive compromise, reducing the depth of the transition trough, which is how I actually interpret a lot of what is really in the Envisioning Real Utopia's book. Right. Is that more just a question of the immediacy of the task?
Yeah, okay. I think that the depth of the transition trough can be ameliorated through interstitial and symbiotic changes over a long period. But those are easier under conditions of positive class compromise. So under conditions of negative class compromise, it's harder to build new institutions that will accomplish those things. Yeah, so that's a good clarification too. Well, gang, it's been a good semester. maybe I don't need to say it, but do stay in touch. I enjoyed working with all of you, and it's always a sense of loss when the semester's over, and I know that some of you I won't see again, but some of you I know I will. But all of you should know that 10 years from now, if you're wandering your way through Madison, you might have to remind me that, oh yes, you took the course this year, but I always appreciate hearing what you're up to and keeping in touch. So thank you for a great semester.
Thank you.
So Eric, here...